Hey there, Math Moment Makers. John and Kyle here to kick things off. You're about to hear a special episode of our podcast being on another podcast. Whoa. So we joined the team over at Unprofessional Development and had a great interview with Tedisco and Mealy. We chatted with them about lots of different things, and we want to replay that here for you.
Yes, that's right. We had a great conversation. Two awesome hosts. We've never met them in person, but having listened to their podcast and just getting their general sense of who they are as educators. And I mean, I think the name says it all, right? Unprofessional Development. You can kind of take it two ways. Like, let's do this kind of off the record, like maybe non-district professional development, but then also let's not be so buttoned up about it as well. So we had a fantastic time chatting with them. It was actually, John, I don't know if you realize this, but it was back April 27th, 2020, when this actually dropped. And we've been putting this one in our queue to release to the Math Moment Maker world. So episode 16 of their podcast, Making Math Moments Unprofessional, is what this from. You should also head over there. They've had some really great guests on there, both math and otherwise. And something I didn't realize until recently is they actually had Tony Danza come a knocking on their door. So I thought that was pretty cool, but we're really excited to share this out with the Math Moment Maker community. Head on over, check out their podcasts, and I'm sure you're going to want to hit that subscribe button as well.
All right, let's do this.
Welcome to the Making Math Moments That Matter podcast. I'm Kyle Pierce from tapintoteenminds.com.
And I'm John Orr from MrOrrIsAGeek.com. We are two math teachers who, together
with you, the community of math moment makers worldwide who want to build and deliver math lessons that spark curiosity,
fuel sense making,
and ignite your teacher moves. John, are you ready to unleash this replay episode from the Unprofessional Development Podcast?
Yes. All right. Now, just before we get into that replay discussion with Tedisco and Mealy, we want to let you know that if you're listening to this before January 29th, 2021, then you're cutting it pretty close to joining us for our 12-week full online workshop.
You are right, John. This is one of our favorite times of year is when we are launching the workshop, because we have so many people who throughout the year ask when it's coming out, and it is happening now. It is designed to walk you through step by step to help you teach through real world problems and to create those resilient problem solvers that you are after.
You're right, Kyle. And I think as of now, after our many, many cohorts through the program, we've had almost 1,000 teachers through the program. So if you're interested in learning more about registering, be sure to check out makemathmoments.com/online workshop. If you're listening after the January 2021 registration close date, you can still head to makemathmoments.com/online workshop to join the waiting list in order to get notified of the next opportunity to participate. And a little birdie told me we'll do it again in the summer.
Absolutely, my friends. Absolutely. So make sure you head on over makemathmoments.com/online workshop. And this particular cohort, the registration is closing on January 29th in the evening. So check it out. Make sure you don't wait. We really hope to do some learning with you beginning in the first week of February.
All right, that's makemathmoments.com/online workshop. Now let's get into our discussion with the team over at Unprofessional Development.
Welcome, unprofessionals, to another episode of Unprofessional Development. I'm Tedisco.
And I'm Mealy.
And today, for the first time, I'm outnumbered.
We've got three math teachers in the house. So we've got myself.
Three math teachers. This was my nightmare in middle school.
Well, I mean,
all right.
John and Kyle from the podcast Making Math Moments That Matter, and also their websites, which I'll link. I'm trying to think. One is Somebody Is a Geek, and the other one is Sparking Curiosity. I'm close. Or
tapping
on there.
The Team Minds. Yeah.
Tapping the Team Minds.
Site is Tapping the Team Minds.
You guys have
you know
a
what
lot
the
of...
problem is? We got too many sites going. It's kind of hard to keep track of them all.
You do, and you have a lot of catchphrases and stuff like that.
We like alliteration.
Yes.
How are you guys doing today?
We are great. It's a fabulous COVID-19 kind of morning, and it snowed here last night, which is seems unheard of. Like, it just piled on the last 24 hours, and
like enough.
It's kind of all melted away, but it's middle of April, usually down south here in Canada south, you know.
That's it.
We're somewhat more tropical than, say, getting snow in April. So usually we're past that point and our grass is growing.
John's really stretching it today. More tropical. More tropical than the rest of Canada. That.
Definitely trying to sell Canada here.
Not sure you know the definition of tropical.
On a map, we're only like a foot away from the tropics. But
It's just ukuleles. You know,
in real life, it's a little
longer.
Luau's
and moose and syrup.
Yes.
But we are fine on this morning.
That's good. So no shoveling is necessary or getting out the snowblower or anything like that.
Yeah,
so
I shoveled once all year. So that's the type of snow that we usually get around here. But
okay.
Being so close to the tropics, I mean, you wouldn't expect that you'd be shoveling that much. But we are doing fine. I know that John is still keeping on his routine. We were talking about this yesterday on a podcast interview. And John's like been getting up early. He's been like right on track. Me, I have like totally gone the other way. I usually get up at 5:30, and it's like, now that I know I don't have to drive to work, I literally just get out of bed, make my coffee, and then start the day. And I think mentally it's the wrong way to handle this right now, but I'm still doing it anyway.
Productivity's actually dropped.
It's tough. It really is. I know there's some things I have to do. I was discussing that with my wife where I'm like, I feel there's like to-do lists that I have, but I'm like, I've got like, you know, if school doesn't go back at all, which is very likely, I've got 5 months to get this to-do list done. So today seems to be my motto.
Right. Like, I could get the dishes now, but they'll be there tomorrow and so will I. So.
Yeah. Well, if you want a fun experiment, start counting up all the time you're saving, not just having to drive. Like in my job, I have to do a lot of driving from school to school. And if I want to go downtown, it's like a good 40 minutes there, 40 minutes back. Yep. So I start to count that up and I'm like, my productivity is going to skyrocket right now. And it's actually quite the opposite.
Yeah.
So,
Yes. Alrighty. So I want to get into a couple of little things to kind of like get to know you a little bit more on like who you're about. We mentioned the podcast and the websites and links to that in the show notes will be going on and all that kind of stuff. So kind of walk us through the journey from being a student to a teacher to being what you guys are as advocates. And we're kind of going to not going to spend a ton of time on it, but I want to kind of get into, for lack of a better word, your philosophy, what it is that you feel about learning. And I know it's math specific, but I think that it really applies to a lot of other teaching practices as well across the board. It's not like your ideas are not just something that only apply to math, as some of them are a little bit. And then I want to kind of share my utilization of some of that as well. So kind of walk through either individually or together how you guys came to be from little bitty lads to like super education podcaster webinar guys.
Gurus.
Yes.
Kyle, you want to start?
What? I'll start us off. I suppose it's going from our own math experience all the way till now. We'll probably be at the end of the COVID quarantine here, social distancing by the time we're done. So we'll do our best to keep it short.
Yeah.
But myself, and I know you'll hear some of these ideas echoed in John's story. I went through school. I was kind of that, I would say average kid, or I shouldn't say average kid, average to me through my own eyes, where I had average grades and I just pushed enough to get that grade that my parents would be happy with. So I can definitely relate to that student. Many of us know that student where they've got a lot there, but there's a lot left in the tank. They don't put that extra effort in.
No.
I didn't see the value in doing that. For me, it was sort of like very, hey, my parents want an 80. I'm going to get them the 80. And when I didn't get the 80, then I always had somebody else to blame for it, right? Instead of myself, which really is something I've learned later. And going through school, I thought I was getting a computer science degree and a math double major. And midway through that, I'd always been thinking about teaching. And I decided midway through university that I'm definitely going to teach and I want to teach math. So I dropped the computer major and off we went. But the big problem that I had was I was like most other math teachers in my philosophy, very fixed mindset. There's some people who are good at math and there's some people who aren't, which we know from research is not true. And I got into the classroom and that's the way I taught for many years, was very procedurally. I didn't necessarily understand the math that I was doing. In university, I actually had a professor when I was about to fail a course, called me into his office during office hours, and he looked me in the face and right in the eyes and said, "You don't know anything about math. You don't belong here."
Wow.
That was his line to me. And it blew my mind. Now, you would think that would be like maybe turning point, but no, I just thought he was a jerk. And I, you
well,
know,
he was a jerk.
And I didn't learn anything from that experience until about 5, 6, 7 years teaching in the classroom, spinning my tires, working really hard. Like I was really hardworking. I wanted to figure this thing out. And many people would say that I was a good math teacher because I was nice to kids. I tried hard. I stayed in at lunch to help, those types of things. Mm-hmm. And I would say all math teachers are like that. They want the best for their kids, but I wasn't getting to those students in the middle and the students at the bottom. And that's when I was lucky enough to go to a conference and see this thing called three-act math that Dan mm-hmm. Meyer was pitching. And it just blew my mind. And from that day forward, I was like, there's something to this. And I knew I wanted to dig into it. And here we are a number of years later, and we're still learning. We're still trying to figure this thing out alongside so many what we call math moment makers in the community. And luckily along that path, John was in a very similar stage. So I'm going to let John kind of tag in here and take us down his memory lane. And maybe we can go from where he and I started collaborating as well.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Thanks, Kyle. I have a very similar story to Kyle. And I think a lot of teachers do that. We were good in math in school, mostly because we were memorizers and could get by. I have a unique spin on my experience as my father is a math teacher or was a math teacher. And I could see that life, like the teacher life, it's not that bad. And you get summers off and all this great stuff that you can come home at 3 o'clock. That's running through my mind. And I hummed and hawed about becoming a teacher. And it was some experiences with tutoring college kids that kind of flipped the switch for me to go, okay, I think I'm going to go into this field. And once I did, I was like Kyle said, I was that traditional teacher. And I think a lot of us in our age group definitely are, because we've never really experienced anything different. You mimic mm-hmm. the teachers that you really enjoyed and that you really liked. And actually, there's really two sides to that, right? You either mimic the teacher that you liked or you do the opposite.
Of the teacher you hated, right?
And it's like, I got to teach math differently. And for me, it was the mimicking. I, for 10 years, taught very traditionally. And that's kind of like my story, is the sense of I was a traditional teacher that kind of switched around and saw something different and needed something to change. I was a teacher where so traditional that we have tracking here in Ontario and we call it streaming our pathways. And I was always teaching our grade 9 path that we call it the applied math path. And it's just kids that are going to maybe go to college or just directly to the workplace. College, like a community college in the United States, whereas right. a smaller college, like a 2-year, 3-year program kind of college.
So just to get clarity on that, yeah. you guys have 2 tiers, 3 tiers, like how many levels are there?
Usually
and what
three.
Level was that? 3.
Yeah,
and that was the middle one or the bottom
yeah,
one?
Yeah, the middle one is the okay. one that I'm referring to. And so it's kids that are like, you know, they're decent, but mostly their experience has been told that they're bad at math throughout mm-hmm. their career. And so they're not in the track to go off to, say, a 4-year university program.
Right.
And so a lot of them hate math. And I was teaching those for 10 years, year after year, because you're told by your department head that you have to put in your dues. You know, you mm-hmm. can't teach those other classes until you put in time in these other yeah. classes. And I was pulling my hair out because I was that traditional teacher. I was teaching every year the same year. And I've used this phrase before. And I'm not sure exactly where I heard it, but I was consider now, was I teaching for 10 years or was I teaching 1 year 10 times?
Yes.
And because I'd never modified, I'd write a lesson plan and I would say, there we go, we're done. And I've put that in my binder and it's good for next year.
Nicely in the binder.
Yeah. yeah. Once that whole lesson's done, that course is set, I never have to do anything else. You know, and I didn't take into account who was sitting in front of me. And because of that, I ended up hating teaching that class. And I
just out of curiosity, just going to pause here for a second.
Oh, sure.
Cough thing going on here. And I've gotten to this point too as well. Did you actually have the answers to some of the worksheets memorized? Like, okay, number sure. number 13 is it's oh,
yeah.
this.
They think you're a magician. Yeah.
Right.
No, like, how do you know?
Sure, this is the one that's the decimal.
Yeah,
the rest of the whole numbers.
I would just go, yep, 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 yep. And kids would throw their hands up and they're like, how does he even know that's right so fast? And it's just because I knew.
I laugh about it. And so many of my teachers might get this joke. Like, how long has that kid been jumping off that cliff in Acapulco for quadratics? Right. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know,
well, that's to make the math real, right? Real. Yes. Jumping off cliffs in Acapulco. You would never jump off a cliff close to home. You got to be closer to the tropics.
To the tropics, like you guys.
Yeah.
Can I ask you guys just a quick sort of question, just a clarification? You guys keep saying I was a traditional teacher.
Yeah.
Can you guys just quickly define, like, exactly, sure. like, what you mean when you say that?
Yeah.
Yeah,
like,
go ahead, yeah sure. Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, for me, a traditional teacher, I imagine my father. And he would, in a math class, your desks are in rows. You would come in and you have the math script. Like, this is in the handbook when you become a math teacher, by the way. So it's like job number one is you must take up the homework, right? Like, it's like, get our homework out. We're going to take it up. We're going to go through the answers. Somebody might put it on the board. You might put it on the board. But it was like, check off, done. Of my lesson plan. Second thing is,
and you plan for 10 minutes and it would take you 45 every single day. It's like, no matter what, after 10 years, you're like, I'm going to plan 10 minutes of homework take up. And then you'd always run out for your lesson. And you're like, how have I not learned this by now that this never happens?
Yeah. Yeah. I would then budget, you know, the next 30 minutes of class. We were usually an hour, 15 minute classes of here is the lesson. I'm going to write notes on the board. I'm going to do examples for you. You're going to copy them down. I'm going to walk through those examples so that those examples are going to look exactly like the homework questions.
And maybe you'll pitch out a couple like easy ones for the kids so you feel like they're doing the example with you. Like it's like, and 7 plus 4, 7 plus 4,
11.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Thank you, Tommy. Thank you, Tommy. And now I feel like we've done this collaboratively, right?
We had some engagement. And then there was always that time where the kids would come back in after you've done this traditional lesson that, did everyone get number 8? No one's getting number 8. And it's like, Mr. Orr, it's because you didn't do an example like that yesterday. And I don't know how to do it. You didn't teach us. It's not fair. And so I never really made kids think. But I think that's where Kyle and I started to make shifts, is in that traditional lesson, which I did for many, many years. And, you know, we're not saying that there's nothing wrong with that. But I did that every single day. And I think there's times where you might run a lesson like that, but there's times where you want kids to think more, because I was doing all the thinking in class when I was delivering lessons that way, and they were doing none of the thinking. Like that example you gave, that Kyle just gave, it's, hey, I'm going to get them to do a little bit of thinking just to show engagement, but really the thinking happens for them after the 45 minutes of you talking and lecturing is done. And then they're all going, I don't know how to do this anyway, because you never really gave them a chance. So we've made that modification to say, let me ask you, who's doing the thinking?
Can we pause you right there and ask you a question? And I think, well, I don't want to use the word trap or whatever, but you might say the teachers fall into the trap of teaching that way, is because 99% of high school math and lower levels as well can be, if you want it to be, algorithmic, as opposed to history or English, where you might have to interpret something, or art, obviously, where you might have to like interpret something. Obviously, you can make art algorithmic as well for certain things. You can teach them how to draw faces and draw the lines and all that kind of stuff. But there is that natural, okay, this is how you complete the square. This is how you do the quadratic formula.
That's
this is how you differentiate.
Time.
And all those things are very algorithmic. And so it's like, if I can teach these kids a recipe, they'll know the recipe, they'll be able to repeat the recipe, and then they'll be able to do that. And I don't know if you guys have used this analogy. I use it with my kids when I'm trying to teach them differently, is there's a difference between being a cook and a chef. And a cook can take the ingredients. They know how to make the exact same dish for the restaurant all the time. They can make that pasta primavera because they know the pasta cooks this long, you use this much cheese, blah, 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 blah. This is how you do it. But a chef can go on Chopped and get like 4 ingredients that they've never used before and go, I understand how ingredients work. I understand things about flavors and cooking time, and temperature and all that kind of stuff. And now I can modify and I can solve this problem here given unique circumstances. Does that make sense?
That analogy.
Yeah. And just to extend that, I love the analogy. And so imagine that cook who's really good at cooking pasta primavera. Now they have unfortunately moved or maybe lost their job. They've gone to another restaurant and it happens to not be an Italian restaurant. Mm-hmm. Now I got to start from scratch again. That's the way I feel we teach so many of our students in math classes. We teach them. So completing the square, when's the last time you've completed the square outside of that one course that it comes up in? There's so much, like, I'm using the word beauty, and I know some people maybe roll their eyes about it, but like, do we really care about them knowing the recipe to these abstract math concepts? Or would we much rather them be able to give them an opportunity to investigate it, to understand how it works, why it works, just like that chef does? That chef understands how those ingredients work and which ones blend well and which ones don't. And they could, that chef could then leave the Italian restaurant, go to a different restaurant and go like, I got this. I know where to go from here. And I can actually use some problem solving, some critical thinking skills. And that's where I see a lot with what John and I are doing with the Make Math Moments framework. I see it as not just being specific to math. We always look at it through a specific math lens, but really it aligns really well with 21st century competencies, right? Like, we're trying to get kids math experiences to become more fluent, more flexible with numbers. Mm-hmm. Even myself, I had no number sense strategies beyond doing algorithms in my head. And that only takes you so far. And if you're lucky enough to have a really like vast working memory, right? Like, if you're a good memorizer, it's likely you could probably do some relatively tricky algorithms in your head. Mm-hmm. But now I see the other side where if I understand how math develops, and that's the part where I think we really struggle in middle school and in high school, is that I never understood why completing the square worked. And that fundamentally is an issue because I can't help my kids bump into that learning if I never received that learning. Mm-hmm. And this is not a knock on teachers. It's that we went through that system. We were taught the recipes and I had the recipes and that's it. I couldn't help them become chefs like you were describing. And I think for us, that's where we've really shifted is what do we want for our students? And that's something John and I always ask at the beginning of a workshop. We always have people turn and talk to their friends, share a math moment like John and I. We haven't shared maybe a specific one, more general. And then we have them talk about what do you want your kids to have 5 years from now after they've left your math class? So even if you're a grade 3 teacher, a grade 8 teacher, a grade 10 teacher, a grade 12 teacher, if you bump into a student 5 years from now, what are you hoping they say? Are you hoping that they can ramble off the quadratic formula to you with no understanding? Or is there something else there? And we've never had anyone say quadratic formula. Nobody says it. But yet, John and I always reference at the end, we only seem to care about those things, though. So we say mm-hmm. we want these things for our kids, but then we reflect on it and we worry so much about the memorization of concepts and procedures that something's out of the line here. And we're just doing what we think is right. And maybe it's because it's the only thing we know. And that's why John and I essentially do what we do. We're trying to help people cut down the time it took John and I, because we were spinning our wheels for years, for multiple decades combined between the two of us. And we want to help people cut out some of that pulling out your hair. Because if you look at John's hairline, look at mine. Mine's even worse. You could tell like we've been pulling out our hair for a long time.
So we've had the rising action and we've gotten to the conflict, right? So what, throw a little English in there for you, Tedesco, okay?
Thanks.
You're welcome.
It makes sense. It's the hero's journey.
Yes. So now we want to know, as I'm sure the listeners are like, well, if we don't teach them like that, then what do I do? So like, give us the elevator pitch on what the alternative is.
Yeah. So what we've been doing for the last number of years is, like Kyle said, putting our hats together, our heads together and thinking about what is the lessons that we've had that were successful and what are the lessons that we had that weren't and what is it really about them? And Kyle mentioned three-act math tests and we had a lot of success with getting kids to think first in engagement and discussion happening in our classroom. And we said, is it because we put a video up, like a short clip up, some scenario and ask kids to notice and wonder, like, is it the video itself? And we've realized that later, yeah, we had a lot of engagement because kids were seeing a video and that was new in math class. That was something different. That wasn't just the traditional four-step process of a math lesson. But we realized later that it's not that. It's there are many more underlying things that are getting our kids involved. You kind of put this idea of a three-part framework, which is not really a three-part lesson. It's three big ideas that we think that need to be considered when designing lessons. So we've got a little bit of flair to this, the three-part framework with, we call it spark, fuel, and ignite. And we want to first talk about sparking curiosity. And when I was in teacher's college, this is not a new idea. We always wanted to hook kids into learning. And how can we spark engagement? How can we get that curiosity going? Because if you can get kids curious about math, then the rest become very, very easy for you to do. And most times in our traditional lesson, we were not sparking that curiosity. We were just going into a lesson going, okay, today we're going to learn about this. And basically we're answering questions in front of kids that kids didn't even want the answers to. Like, we're posing questions, like kids are like, I didn't even want to know that. And now I have to figure that out. Like, is that curiosity?
Right.
No, we want to drive that questioning so that they go, I kind of want to know what's next. I want to know what the answer is here. So we got to spark curiosity, and we've got a lot of resources available, which we can share later about how to do that in your classroom. Mm-hmm. Kyle, why don't you jump in and talk about what the next step is about fueling sense making?
Hey, Math Moment Makers, Kyle here. And I've got just a quick message specifically for our district level mathematics decision makers out there. Do you feel like you're spinning your wheels when making district level goals for mathematics programming from kindergarten through grade 12? Setting new goals each year only to find little to no real shift in pedagogical practice or educator content knowledge across the district as a whole? Take a moment to book a short call with our team so we can learn more about your specific district and educator learning needs in mathematics so we can assist you in taking the first step of many in the right direction. Visit makemathmoments.com/district to book a web call with our team today. We have a limited number of spots for districts just like yours, so don't wait. Head to makemathmoments.com/district and grab a spot in our calendar now.
Yeah, fueling sense making is one where John and I think, spent the majority when we were on this, we had these epiphanies and we were like, wow, Dan Meyer, really, we constantly are tipping our cap to him because he, for us, or I should say for me, I know John had Marion Small as well, was another really influential person or math educator for him as well with her open questions. And when we hit that point, I was hyper focused on curiosity and I was getting, I would say, pretty good at the curiosity. There was still big gaps there. There was still like the lesson flops where you're like, in your mind, this is going to be awesome. You go and it's like crickets and you're like, how come? Like, I did the video, right? And that's John referenced it already. Is it really just about a video? No, because I've walked out of a movie theater before. So it's not about just a video. There's other elements that have to be going on there. And our English friends would definitely know, like, when you're talking about a story, like, we have to craft and script our math lessons like that story and take those students on that hero's journey, like John has mentioned. So we were getting better at that, still had big gaps along the way. But then once we got past the interesting question, the provocation, that curiosity, it was like we flipped a switch and then we went back to teaching kids procedurally again. Mm-hmm. So it was like almost like kids knew, they're like, well, if we just wait this out, Mr. Orr, Mr. Pierce is going to finally just tell us what to do. Right. And then we'll be back to the way things used to be. And a lot of kids would, to be honest, a lot of kids, especially kids who have done well in that system. So I'm picturing myself as a student. I would be that kid who would be like, I would much rather just sit back and you just tell me what I need to memorize. Like,
can I just take notes? Can we just take notes? I want to just take notes.
Totally. Totally. And that's really hard on teachers, right?
Oh.
Like, teachers who want to change their thinking, they're trying hard and kids are begging for them to stop. And that's where a lot of teachers will, like, they'll say, ah, I guess they don't like this. But then we'd get to this place where I would then teach them procedurally again. And what we realized is that we were missing the sense making part of mathematics. And I'm looking at the sense making part as something that not only drives me. Before it was curiosity. Curiosity was like driving me to continue learning and continue doing more. And it's still something that I think is really important because I need them to look my direction and to give me their attention. But if I don't understand how the math develops, and if I don't understand where kids are coming from and where they're going, then I can't really help them. It'll be like John was mentioning, where we were planning our lessons for one student in mind, right? Like, this note is perfect for the student that I have envisioned in my head, but only three kids in my class are that student. And then everybody else, I don't know what to do about. So this sense-making part is like, how does the math work? How are we going to help kids to develop that procedure, that recipe later? Like, chefs eventually develop a recipe, but only after they've done all of that investigation, trying, tinkering. Like, we need to give kids that experience. And that, for us, is that fueling sense-making piece.
That's awesome. Speaking of that, one of the things that I do in my class, I don't know if this fits whatever, but we actually tie in two things together. And people who aren't math, you're like, oh, I hate those words. They're just using math words. I don't understand that. But I've done completing the square and we've taught them that. And then I said, hey, what if it was just AX squared plus BX plus C, and we don't have that? Now we understand the recipe for completing the square. So let's do this. And the quadratic formula comes out of that. And then you can kind of like tie those two things together and make numbers sense and go, oh, look at this. And like,
it's the same.
It's like, I'm like, yes, see this formula? Someone was playing around with this thing and they said, how can I get X by itself? Because that is one of the things we love to do, is get X by itself. And they try, what if I use this with this? And then I'm like, and do that. And so they're making that connection. And yeah, it's tough because sometimes that recipe is always there and you know it's there. And the kids inherently know that it's there, and it is easy to default to that. And also, the pressure of time and the test and everything else. It's like, sometimes some teachers, I think they get like, oh my God, we did all this. We didn't even get to covering the quote unquote standard that was for today, because we got lost in the weeds over here, which is actually a good thing and good for the kids. But then we get to that. So I want to kind of share a little personal experience, and then we want to kind of go and see where else the conversation takes us. So one of the things, like I said, I've told you before we started recording that I've listened to you guys. I don't know, maybe I've listened to like 15 episodes. I don't even know how I discovered you guys. I'm a podcast junkie. And so I was looking for education podcasts, and there's a lot of them out there that are kind of like just not super engaging. And then I said, making math moments that matter. Oh, that sounds important to me. I'll put that on. And I listened to you guys, and I just, your guys' excitement and your guys' experiences and whoever the guests would be on, that you would, the guests that you would have on, which is various teachers. And sometimes it's experts, like you're talking about Dan Meyer, who maybe this is, you know, I hope you guys are getting this and appreciating this, but you guys now are the Dan Meyer to other people. There's other people that are going, I learned this from the Making Math Moments Matter guy, or they might say your names directly. But anyway, the spiraling, and I'm just going to kind of give like a 2-minute elevator pitch of the spiraling, because I used it this year. It was something that I heard on your guys' show, and I said, that sounds ridiculously fun. Let me do that. And so spiraling is, I'm going to try and do my best explanation of it, whether it's history, whether it's English or whatever, which English we've talked to Disco, you get to do things a lot differently because you can cover all your standards in one lesson because it's a lot of things tied together.
I agree. We are the best.
Right. But history and science and math are very often broke up into these units, where unit one, sometimes it's chronologically for history, for science and math, it's like, okay, today we're going to learn about the environment, and tomorrow we're going to learn about space, or we're going to learn about this type of thing. But instead, with spiraling, what you do is take the units and introduce each one in the first 5 to 9 days. And if you guys can correct me if I'm doing it wrong or whatever, but the first 5 to 8 days, however many units you have, introduce each unit and to get the foundation of that and spark that curiosity about that unit and get them feeling comfortable with it. And then come back to the initial unit 8 days later and go, okay, now we're going to build on what we learned. We might tie in a little bit from this other unit here because we want to make those connections. And basically we go through each unit, I call them rounds, and we go around and around and around, coming back and back and forth, and then interspersing and connecting and doing all that kind of stuff. And it was, for me as a teacher, and I believe that most of my kids, really, really awesome this year. And one of the side benefits was that as we've left school now and gone home, my kids, unlike other teachers, have seen every single unit already. Now, they haven't gotten deep into every single thing in the unit. You know, there's kids that know stuff that they don't know, obviously, but they have seen the breadth of the course.
They've got the big ideas.
Right. And it's really, really cool. So awesome. I just want to kind of give you guys props on that. And I'll definitely put links to that. And I forget which one of you did it that has like the like three or five videos on people who want to spiral and learning how to spiral. Because that was really, really super helpful.
Hey there, Math Moment Makers. Are you a dedicated listener? Like, I'm talking, have you been listening for a couple months, maybe even a couple years? Well, if you haven't taken a moment to leave us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform, it would mean so much to us. It'll take you under 1 minute so that you can help more educators see and experience the Making Math Moments That Matter podcast. Do us this huge solid. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts. And here is today's episode.
Yeah, Kyle's got a three-part email series on how to spiral your math class on tapintoteamminds.com. And when you sign up to that each day, you get a video about how to do that. And he answers lots of big questions. You've given a quick summary here, which is awesome. But Kyle kind of goes into the details of how to do that in your classroom, what to watch out for, how to start up, what's the theory behind it. And the theory behind it really comes from learning theory and the idea that most math we do is masked practice. We learn one thing really fast and then we move on. And it gives the illusion that the kids know the material and have learned the material. And it's really because it's still in their fresh in their minds that hasn't really sunk in yet. Maybe it has, maybe it hasn't, but we don't really know. And it's not until after time goes on that you can actually test to see if it's sunk in. And, and whereas spiraling flips that around and it does chunked practice or spaced practice, which says is way better for learning. And there's a couple books that we read about that. One was, I think it's How We Learn. Kyle, is that the correct title?
Benedict Carey, I think.
Yeah. And the second one that we got a lot of value of is Make It Stick, I think. And it goes into the learning behind that. But we aren't the ones that started this idea. We actually built these ideas in our classes off a teacher from Ottawa who we highly respect, Al Overwick, who kind of jumped into this. He did that, but he also did something that we also did in our class. Because there's two ways to think about spiraling in a sense. It's one, you could just take all the units and space them out. And so, like you said, it's like you could do chapter 1.1 today and 1.2 tomorrow and then leave that for a little bit and then do 2.1. And so you could do that. But what Al advocates is that you should teach through problems. And that's kind of what we're doing with our framework and spiraling kind of put together. It's how can we put problems in front of kids so that they're problem solving and bring out the math? And Al has a really great phrase that says that most of the time we think about covering curriculum or covering standards. And what he does in his class is uncover curriculum or uncover standards. And
that's nice. I like that.
Yeah, it's great. It's a nice phrase to just say, hey, am I covering it or am I like starting with problems and pulling the math from it that just emerges?
Yeah.
And when you start with problems and if you carefully choose those problems, you can uncover standard 1A and 1B and maybe 4C from that same problem.
Yeah.
And when you go to do a different problem, you might cover three different standards. And as you do this over and over again, you're covering the whole, all the standards or all the curriculum in various times. And you're also spacing it out. So it's better for the learning. So that's what we're trying to do with the framework. But really the credit goes to Al Overwick and the team at his school that started doing this a number of years ago. And he presented these ideas at conferences here in Ontario.
Yeah.
Did you have any questions?
Jimmy Pye as well. I want to make sure Jimmy Pye gets in there because I know he works closely with Al as well. So two great educators to follow online.
Yeah, they do some great sessions at conferences.
Tedisco, did you have any questions? Was this, you know, because some of this stuff I've mentioned to you before and some of this stuff is not exactly you're super familiar with. What questions did you have, Tedisco?
Oh, so
or comments.
I'm just going to play devil's advocate just for a quick moment. So you guys say you want to make it more engaging, really pull the kids in and make them really curious. But devil's advocate for a second, why? Like, why can't I just give them a worksheet? Why can't we just work? I mean, the textbook's there. Why can't I just say, open to page 371?
You could.
So devil's advocate.
Go ahead, Kyle.
I think it's a great question because I think fundamentally a lot of people too, like when we get a little bit of pushback, when we get a little bit of that devil's advocate, we never want teachers, I shouldn't say never, because I think at some point some teachers may have interpreted what we're saying is that they ditch everything they're doing and We now are very, very, very explicit about that. We actually ran a workshop or an online webinar recently where we were talking about transforming your textbook into curious problems kids want to solve. And what we're saying is it's the approach that we're looking at. We're not saying ditch a textbook. I know that there's a book ditch the textbook. And I know that there's all these kind of things out there. Even people now, I feel like the word worksheet or handout is like not allowed. Like, you know, if
it's an activity.
Yes.
My principal told me that years ago. You're not doing a worksheet. You're doing an activity. I'm like, oh, right. Okay. Well, that's yeah, I'm not a exactly. garbage man. I'm a sanitation engineer. I appreciate that.
Exactly.
I'm not a teacher. I'm an educator. Like, okay, good for you. Yeah.
Exactly. And it really, it all comes down to intentionality. And I think a lot of teachers actually put themselves in a bad spot when they take everything they've ever done, especially like picture a 15-year teacher. Maybe they're sitting listening right now and they're like, oh my gosh, I'm exactly the person that Kyle and John described of creating the binders and doing all those things. Like, let's be honest, if you haven't done that ever in your life, you're probably all over the place and have no idea what's going on. It's almost like you have to at least get to a point of having organization, understanding the course you're teaching and all of those things. Like a first year teacher, I'm never advocating for them to spiral because I'm like, you don't even understand what it's going to look like yet. Teaching kids,
right.
How long is this going to take? So I'm like, no, maybe hang on to that for now. Let's get started. But how can I, instead of me teaching all the stuff and then giving a handout, how could I give kids an experience first? And then based on what the kids do, that informs us. And that actually brings up our third part of the framework, which is igniting teacher moves. This is the part that I think is probably the most art-like of the framework, where it's a craft. You have to practice it. You'll never be perfect at it. You'll always have some lessons that don't necessarily go the way you want, but it's about anticipating what kids will do when you put them in this productive struggle. So I want to make sure that, Tedisco, I take you and I take you on a path during my lesson so that you have an experience. And then based on what you do, how you handle the problem, that's going to help influence my part where I now bring it all together and make those connections and I start consolidating the learning. So right now during remote learning, there's a lot of teachers that are like, how do I do this? And John and I are trying to help teachers with trying to do what we're discussing today. It's definitely easier to do face to face, but it's still very difficult if your experience in a math class is coming in, getting a note, and then doing a bunch of questions, practice questions. So we're not advocating that kids don't do purposeful practice. Notice how I put a spin on there, purposeful practice. Right. It's kind of like teacher educator or whatever. But the idea that like the questions we're going to give kids aren't necessarily the exact same questions that we gave every other group of kids. It's based on what happened today. And you're like, oh, question one, two, you know what? We're going to... one's off. I'm going to add in this other one because I think you're ready for this one. And I'm going to give you a good amount of practice because you still need practice, but we just wanted to change the experience to get you there. So it's not about throwing out things. It's about rearranging things and maybe trying to get kids to be more like that chef instead of more like that cook to kind of go back to that same idea or storyline from earlier.
I'll just add something onto that to address the why. Like, I really like the cook analogy myself. And the question about like, why are we doing this is, if you think about every time we talk to a non-educator about math education, we ask them like, we're in the car ride or the Lyft ride to the airport or Uber. And they're saying like, how did you enjoy your math experience in school? And 2/3 of people are hating this, right? It's like, I hated math class. And
even the ones who said they were good at it, they were like, it wasn't my favorite class, but like I was still pretty good at it.
Math gets a bad rap. Movies put in math things when they want school to look hard. It's like, we're gonna throw in the word trigonometry in here because we want this to be hard.
I can't even pronounce it.
Right. You know, and
meme so like, with all the formula, the GIF with all the formulas like going around the pyramid and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Right?
Like there's so many bad math experiences that people have. And one of the things of why we've named the podcast Making Math Moments That Matter is partly is we want to change that, right? Like I don't want a society anymore that says math is the evil and we hated math and we wear that as a badge of pride. like, oh, I was bad at math. I'm proud of that. Like,
you don't
say you're bad at
reading.
So
silly.
But you would say you're bad at math is something that people are like, yeah, me too. Oh, yeah. We hated it. Like, we don't want that anymore.
And no one says, I'm bad at reading. I really am bad at the reading. It's like, well, how is it okay? You know?
So
maybe you'll say you're bad at spelling, but no one says, I'm bad at reading. I'm not really good at it.
Yeah.
Like, well, you would never admit to that, but yet you admit that you don't know your times tables or whatever it is. We were just not math, by the way.
Yeah. And so we would run workshops and there would be very traditional math teachers. Like, why change? I'm like, well, how is it working for you right now? Like, are kids liking math? Are they hating it? Like, what are we really doing here? And that's one of our big goals is we want to change math instruction so that people do not have negative math experiences, but we also want to change them so that the kids understand and can be those chefs. So I think these are some big kind of ideas that Kyle and I always think about as we design things and help our teachers.
And again, I feel like we could go on all day about this, but also I think fundamentally one of the hardest parts in having that shift is that we as the teacher, John and I, had to accept the fact that we weren't as good at math as we thought we were. So like, let that sink in for
a
second.
My professor was
right. My teacher's listening. My professor was 100% accurate and it didn't hit me until like 10 years into teaching when all this started happening and I started to realize, I'm like, I am teaching kids how to do stuff that I don't actually understand. So like, imagine how would that go? And I'm going to use hockey because we're from Canada, but in the US, let's say football, you have a football coach and your football coach understands all the plays. Like he has all the plays memorized, but he has no idea. He doesn't understand why the plays work. Right. He doesn't understand when you would use the plays, how you would change the scenario when you see, oh my God, the other team just did, what do they call that? An audible or something?
Right.
Oh my gosh, they're moving. Now what do I do? For me as a teacher, I didn't have that ability. I didn't have the chef ability to be able to take those different recipes and put them together and deal with something when something goes wrong. So when I say goes wrong, like imagine your cook in the kitchen, which is our student, is putting together this recipe and they add the wrong ingredient. How do I help that student now make that dish whole? And for me, like we're just hammering this example of the chef and the cook, but in the classroom, kids are going to be solving math problems. Then when they go down a path that you weren't anticipating, if I as the educator don't understand like the chef understands, if I don't understand the math, how do I help that student without robbing them of their thinking and saying, nah, don't do it that way. Mm-hmm. I did that for years. Don't do it that way. That's going to take you on a crazy path. Now I realize I'm like, kids have to go down that path. They have to go and explore and realize that like, oh yeah, that isn't going to work very well for me. Where do I want to go back to pivot back and try to get on course here and get closer to that answer, that open middle sort of experience. But if I don't understand the math, then this is very difficult to do. So unless I'm willing to accept that and say, maybe I don't know as much as I know, and that means my ego is going to take a huge hit. My pride is going to take a huge hit. I need to have that before I can start to kind of move away from that traditional approach.
Okay. So a couple things, and I hope you brought some funny stories because we love funny stories. But the other thing I want to kind of like talk about is, so what's it like to be an edu celebrity? And like, do you guys feel famous? And how did you go from like, okay, this is a really good idea to I'm going to have a website and I'm going to have a podcast to, hey, we need you to come here and we're going to have like the entire district.
I feel like we should bring our wives on at this point because they'll set you straight.
But you guys go to various districts and I know you guys have online webinars, but are you called upon to go over here and to there and we're going to have you speak at?
Well, not right now, but.
Right. But in the past, you guys have spoken like the National Council of NCTM or whatever. Yeah. Have you guys spoke there?
Yeah, we've been there the last couple of years and various other regional conferences in the United States, plus here in Canada. We've been traveling a lot the last couple of years across Canada, across states. We even got some trips booked, hit Australia next year and a couple other places. So yeah, it's like Kyle said, I don't think we view ourselves that way. Still, I think this is what most people would say, right? When you ask a question like that.
Was the plan to like, hey, we've got this thing. Was the plan like, hey, if we do this, you know, and it's okay if it wasn't.
Yeah, it was
you know?
Very incremental. There was a time where we started to collaborate mostly because we were doing the similar things in our classrooms. Like we don't teach in the same district, but we do live close to each other so we can get together and hash things out. that's kind of where that journey began. It was kind of like, hey, you're doing these things in your classroom and I'm doing these things in my classroom. Why don't we collaborate and share ideas back and forth? And we started sharing when we started spiraling. We kept a Google Sheet that we just said, hey, you're doing this in this class and I'm doing this. And that's how things
began. Why did you do this activity here and I did this one? Did you like the way that went? Yeah. Or, you know, here's how mine went. And we just kind of went back and forth.
And then the framework kind of came together. And while we were thinking about here in Ontario, we have a big conference every year in May. And it's kind of like our big NCTM conference, but it's called OAME. And we were saying, hey, why don't we do a joint session at the conference and work on some of the ideas that we've been talking about. And so that's where Making Math Moments That Matter kind of spawned from and the framework. And from there, it was incremental. It was, we did that session there and then we did another session somewhere else. And we hooked up with Robert Kaplinski from California, who was doing online workshops and he helped us build an online workshop.
Okay, because he's going to be our guest, I think either this weekend or next weekend, Robert on.
Yeah. Robert kind of guided us through that process on his grassroots workshops platform. And then we were there with him for a number of sessions and moved on to do our own platform. And that created the Academy. And then kind of podcast came after that. So that's the kind of journey of it was very incremental. It wasn't like we sat down and we're like, let's create this thing where we're going to
take over the math world.
We're going to travel the world and do webinars. Like, everything was always let's do this now and let's see what happens.
Yeah, I think we started our blogs, our personal blogs, back. I think mine was like 2012 or something like that. Or 2011, I was doing like a project through the Ministry of Education here and Ontario Teachers Federation and just started blogging what was happening. And that was kind of what sort of grew from there. But it's been, like a 10-year journey. Wow. From that, if you go back on either of our blogs, they're probably still there. That first post where it's like, hi, I'm Kyle. I'm a math teacher and I'm going to start blogging. Check back next week and you'll learn about how I completed the square or something like that. Right. And it just kind of grew from nothing. But yeah, it definitely took quite a while. And it's just as you see more and more people are, like you were saying, when they come in, they say like, wow, I learned this from so-and-so or this. And then every now and again, someone says they learned something from my site or John's site or the Make Math Moments site. It fuels you to keep doing it. And it's what we do in our spare time.
Yeah, it's like our hobby.
Geek out on math.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Tisca, you've been really quiet, by the way. Are you awake?
It's outnumbered.
Mostly. You guys keep talking about, what's it called? Math. That was it. X equals negative B plus minus squared B squared minus 4AC over 2A.
You have to sing the song to Disco. That's how you learn, okay? But anyway.
I do have a question that I've always wanted to ask math teachers.
Okay.
Because you guys have way more periphery than me in this sort of area. So I once read a blog, so you know it's true, where the guy wrote about what he called the futon theory. Oh. And basically he said that he was moving a futon once. And a piece fell out, like they heard a piece fall down the stairs, but they couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. And then after that, basically the futon worked for a little while, but eventually it just kind of broke down. And he said, this is kind of how math works. This is his theory. He's like, this is kind of how math works, because like as you go along, eventually you lose a piece. And that's why at some point you just kind of hit a peak of how much math you can learn or understand because you lost a piece along the way. So
very interesting analogy.
That's really strange. And by the way, I have no idea why, but it just occurred to me that futon actually sounds like it could be part of an atom, but it isn't. I know there's neutrons and electrons, but are the futons somehow in the atom?
Because it feels like a science teacher when you need them.
We should have a futon in the atom. I think that'd be awesome. I'd love to see a kid write down futon as their answer for, you know, if you've got this many protons, you need to have.
How many futons?
How many futons do you have?
A cheap, uncomfortable couch that just rotates around a neutron. Right.
Yes.
So what happens there? Like, is there a point where, like, we hit a peak in mathematics where we just can't learn anymore? Or
I don't know if I'm going
to along the way.
I don't know if I'm going to agree with these guys, if these guys are going to agree with me or not, because I know you guys are like, and I think the growth mindset is like there's a truth to it and then there's a pie in the sky idealism to it that I think sometimes can not be true. And I think people hit what I call a math wall. And the analogy I use is like I don't care how good a coach you are, I'm not going to get a little person to be able to dunk a basketball. No matter how much I growth mindset them and no matter how much I encourage them and whatever else I can do, I can get them where they can jump higher. I can get them where they're closer to dunking, but they can't ever dunk.
Yeah. That's an interesting way to think about it, whereas you're equating a physical capability with something that's a mental capability. Mm-hmm. So I don't know about all of that. I know that there's some truth in the futon thing, and I know that there's some truth in the wall, right? It's like kids will hit a wall. People hit a wall for sure. And I think it's exactly what Todisco has said in the sense that something fell out along the way a long time ago, and it's really hard to get that back. I would say it's not impossible to get that back, whereas it'd be almost impossible to dunk the basketball in your situation. Whereas,
right.
And I think that's part of what we try to do early on in the sense of building sense making with our students is that we're trying to eliminate the futon piece from falling out. We're right. trying to say, like, let's build sense making early so that we have the building blocks and the ways to make connections so that it's less likely that those pieces are going to fall out along the way. And I know that it's going to be true. Like, there are going to be kids that have pieces fall out along the way. It's just how it's going to work.
Right.
And we're just trying to reduce that. And so if you have a piece fall out along the way, it's, I'm not going to say you can't fix that or you can't put it back in, but I think it's really, really hard to put it back in later versus earlier.
And I also think too, there's kind of a couple things there. Like, I definitely agree, similar to the physical scenario, if there's a mental disability, if there's all of those things definitely factor in. But I think fundamentally, one of the hardest challenges for us as math teachers in trying to help is that if we're teaching procedurally, those pieces we're talking about are very different pieces. Where if we're learning conceptually, pieces can fall out, and that happens over time just with retention, for example. Yeah. Like, you know, I forget, but if I have conceptual understanding and if that's how I know math works, then I can go back and I can try to retrace my steps. Whereas if it's procedural and a piece is missing, I get kind of roadblocked. You know, I always use the example of the analogy of driving to work. Like, if the road is closed and I only understand how to get to work procedurally, that one piece out of my puzzle shuts me down for the day. I've got to turn back home and I got to go. But if I understand the neighborhood, if I understand the area and I can problem solve, I can now find a different route to get me to work. And math does work that way.
Yeah.
But again, there are some, we'll say, boundaries there as well, where maybe we get to a level where the amount of abstract thinking is so high that maybe there's a mental disability that might be hindering or a problem like that. But otherwise, I definitely believe that teaching conceptually will help the equalizer, the great equalizer, and help bring equity to mathematics.
Yeah.
And so, you like just I got said, a little show from Landon. So,
I'm not throwing the growth mindset baby out with the bathwater. I'm just saying that I don't think that it is the panacea that some people are like, oh, we just need, I don't know.
And it's like, you got to walk the walk and you can't just talk the talk with growth mindset, right? Like, I can have the posters on the wall that say, try really hard and you'll get there. But then if I'm teaching only procedurally, and if, let's say, it's a one and done test, then as the teacher, I'm not walking the growth mindset walk anyway. So it's definitely not going to help in those cases for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the part where we like to hear funny stories. So I want to hear from you guys. It can be something that happened in the classroom that we tried to do some kind of, which I tried to spark curiosity and it went sideways this way, or we were having a seminar and it just got really ugly and this happened, or something that when you, I'm sure you've been teaching a good while, you get these like go-to stories when you're at a party or whatever that you tell and just crack people up about. Cause we know, just like you're, son there is having a good time. The kids in the classroom do stuff and say stuff that is hysterical almost every single day.
Yeah, for sure. And I think
I know John's. I already know, I think.
Maybe you'll have to remind me. I was trying to think of something funny and you probably have to remind me because I don't think this is the one that you're thinking of, even though I don't know which one you're thinking of. I think there's lots of fail stories in the classroom for sure, especially around trying to spark curiosity, because that's how you're going to learn. It's, you're going to try to do something and then it's going to fail the first time, the second time, but you will get better at it. But something that always come to my mind, this is back when I first started teaching and I was that teacher that it was my way or the highway, and I was a very traditional teacher. And I was teaching like a very disruptive kind of class. And a kid came up to me while we were doing an activity, and it was near the end of class. And he said, "Somebody stole my cell phone off my desk." And I said, "Oh." And then I had this thought, I'm like, no one should be stealing anything in their classroom. And so I was like, "Ugh." I closed the door and the bell was just about to ring. And I said, "No one's leaving this room until that cell phone comes back." So the bell rings and the kids don't go anywhere. And one kid stands up and he's like, "I'm not sticking around here for this. I got to go. It's lunchtime, right?" So they want to get out of there. And I said, "Nope, no one's going anywhere." And this kid, he turns to the window, he opens the window, he hops out.
Oh, nice.
He just goes out. And I was like, oh my, I remember being really angry at the time, but I look back, it's pretty funny. And I'm like, he just left. And then two other kids followed him, jumped out the window.
Oh my God.
See, and what I'm happens like, is you taught them like, creative thinking skills.
Yeah.
Yes. And I was like, look at the situation.
That is problem solving.
And another kid turns to me and says, "Mr. Orr, can we go?" And I'm like, "No." And he's like, "We're not going anywhere until that cell phone's returned." And then another kid turns to me, because I didn't realize it. Another kid turns to me, he's like, "What happens if it was the guy that jumped out the window?"
What?
So then I was like, "You're right." And it probably was him. So I let everybody go. And the admin vice principals, they looked into it. It was the kid who jumped out the window that did steal the cell phone.
Oh my God. That's hysterical.
I don't think, Kyle, that's the one you were thinking of, but
no,
what do you got?
Well, as soon as they said about, you know, when with sparking curiosity, like when things go wrong or whatever, and I thought you were going to share right away, because you share it sometimes when we present, is we always talk about those inappropriate comments when we do a notice and wonder, and students,
bring up
things
that
are unrelated or maybe even inappropriate things. And the one time John's playing this video for the first time, and it's him creating, it's called the R2-D2 problem, and he's using sticky notes similar to Andrew Stadell's file cabinet sticky note problem. And he's making this piece of art that's going to end up being R2-D2. And he asked them, "What do you notice or wonder?" And the one student said, "I noticed your underwear," because it's like pause and his underwear is showing.
Right? Yeah, you can see like the top of my underwear sticking out of my pants at the pause.
Oh, that's good stuff.
It was funny.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. When it comes to sparking curiosity, I don't remember any like definitely fails, but they weren't funny fails. They were actually kind of like made you feel not so great, because, you know, I was missing certain pieces, or I didn't leave it open enough for students to share what they really noticed and wondered. But John's story reminded me, and I wasn't going to mention this, but one time a student fell asleep in my class, and it was a grade 12 class. Good kid too. Like, we had a good relationship. So it wasn't like we were picking on the student or anything. And I went to my colleague who's next door, and he's a real prankster. His name's Dave. And I said, "Hey, so-and-so's sleeping over here." And he goes, "Get your whole class out and go into the courtyard and then page the office and have the office page into the classroom." So that was our move there. Wow. So we had the whole class staring outside in the courtyard looking in, and we called to the office and said, "Hey, page for so-and-so." I feel horrible. I can't even remember his name. I have his face right in my mind.
That's okay. We just say George. But, around here.
They paged in, and the look on the student's face when he woke up, and he like panicked. He's looking around. Everybody's gone. He's like, "What time is it?" Oh, it was great. The whole class is laughing. A good time with that one.
Yes. I knew a fellow teacher. You know, we say often, don't try this at home. But so a kid fell asleep in class. He took scotch tape and scotch taped the kid to his desk. I mean, he used like whole roll. I wish I had a picture
of it. You got to be in a deep sleep to get, you know.
Right. That, you know? And I guess maybe he like knocked on the desk. We all know the knock on the desk trick to get the kids awake. So I guess he had tried that, and the kid was just completely out. I don't know if the situation, the kid was sick, the kid was chemically enhanced.
I was going to say, the next move, I think, is check the pulse. You know what I mean?
And just take the scotch tape. Oh, I'll tell another one. Wow. This is a good story, just because I have all these funny stories in my head that I don't. You're sparking funny stories. So the same actual teacher, when he was out, told me this story. And substitute teacher, and I don't know about you guys up there, but a lot of our substitute teachers are older. Maybe it's somebody who's retired from teaching. Maybe it's someone who's retired from whatever, and they're just looking for a little part-time job and something to do.
Mm-hmm.
So the teacher falls asleep. The substitute teacher falls asleep. By the way, this same substitute fell asleep when I was homesick and gave my – during giving my midterm. My kids did so good on that midterm. But but the kids showed video of the teacher the next day. So the substitute falls asleep. He's this guy. He's, I don't know, 70 years old. He has no teeth. So that adds to the thing. So the kids took sharpened pencils and threw them into the ceiling. You know how you can get the ceiling, the pencils to stick into like the drop ceiling, all above his head. So then the guy's there lying asleep and they're videoing him, and the pencils, they only stay there so long and they work their way out and they hit the guy. So the guy is like asleep snoring, and then you see him when the pencil hits him, and you're, what? And then he kind of looks around and then right back to sleep.
Bold.
Wow.
Yeah, bold. Children will be children, and adults, I guess, will be adults because we still find that funny.
Wow. Yes. Wow. it's just good stuff. There's so much fun stuff. Okay. Well,
For sure.
We really appreciate having you guys on. It has been an absolute blast. And I hope the people out there listening appreciate it. And then we've sparked some curiosity to find out stuff about you. And they will be looking at you up and finding out more of your stuff. And we'll continue to promote you guys. So
you guys definitely gave me a lot to think about. So if people want to find you too online, where can they find you?
Probably the best place right now is to head to mcmathmoments.com. Which is where you can find the podcast. You can find our information about our workshops, our online workshops, and we have a virtual summit that we run every year. So an online virtual conference that's free for everybody. So you can find info about all of our stuff at makemathmoments.com. That's kind of like our main hub. And then I think you can branch off to get our other sites, which are tapintoteamminds.com. That's Kyle's kind of blog, plus lots of resources. And then my site, which is mrorr-isageek.com. So those are three sites. Kyle, you want to add anything in there?
Twitter? No, I think that's probably your home base. Like John said, right now we also have a teacher due to the COVID situation. We've got a lot of teachers looking for extra PD. So we've got a teacher license free for folks to access the academy if they want to check that out. makemathmoments.com/trial. And yeah, we'll be chatting with more math moment makers in the community area.
Awesome.
Great.
Awesome. And do you guys have the high five sound effect? Can you push a button and play it, or do we have to like?
We do it every time.
It's a real clap. We do it. It's a real clap every time.
Oh, is it? So it's not a button you push or something that you add in?
No, we claps every time.
Okay. So to this guy, like I said, listen to one that like we say thank you and stay unprofessional. That's kind of our closing. But you guys do your little closing thing for us.
All right. Go ahead, Kyle.
All right. Well, that's it for us. I'm Kyle Pierce.
And I'm John Orr.
High fives for us.
And high fives for you.
Love it.
We didn't get the last one. Love it.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
That was awesome. So appreciate you guys. All right. Thanks.
Well, my friends, thanks for listening to this replay episode with the team over at Unprofessional Development Podcast. Again, do them a solid and head on over, go check out a couple of their other episodes. They're doing great things over there, and we were honored to have the opportunity to jump on there and do some chatter about how we can make math moments for students, regardless of the grade level and regardless of student readiness.
Before you head off, we want to let you know that if you're listening to this before January 29th, 2021, then you're cutting it close to joining us for our 12-week full online workshop.
Yes, this online workshop is designed specifically for you so that we can walk you through step by step to help you teach through real world problems and really contextual problems that spark curiosity, fuel sense making, and ignite teacher moves. We talk about it all the time on the podcast, but sometimes it can be a little bit harder trying to piece things together when you want to put it into your own practice. So work together with John and I so that we can help create those resilient problem solvers that we all are seeking for our students.
If you're interested in learning more about registering, be sure to check out makemathmoments.com/online workshop. If you're listening after the January 2021 registration, you can still head to makemathmoments.com/online workshop to join the waiting list in order to get notified of the next opportunity to participate.
Yes, my friends, it is closing on January 29th, I think it is, 2021 in the evening. And we're going to be at it on February 1st. That's when we are going to officially start the 12-week online workshop. It is self-paced, so there's no scheduling to do on your part. You get to, well, I guess there is scheduling, John, right? You have to schedule in the time for you to go through at your pace and on your schedule. However, we do our best to try to help guide you along through that process as well. So head on over to makemathmoments.com/online workshop. Learn more about it, and hopefully you'll consider diving in, because it is always a fantastic group, lots of great conversation, and we're really excited to get going for this cohort.
In order to ensure you don't miss out on new podcast episodes as they come out each week, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.
Also, if you're liking what you're hearing, do us a huge solid, hit that subscribe button, but also go ahead and tap on a rating. It only takes a second. And if you're ever so kind, leave a short review on Apple Podcasts to help us grow the podcast. You don't know how full our hearts become when we see those reviews coming in, and it just fuels us to keep on going and keep these episodes running.
Show notes and links to resources from this episode and full transcripts from this episode can be found at makemathmoments.com/episode 111. That's makemathmoments.com/episode 111.
Well, my math moment maker friends, I'm Kyle Pierce.
And I'm John Orr.
High fives for us.
And a big high five for you.
If you are a district leader of mathematics, a math coach, a math curriculum coordinator, a superintendent, a principal, getting teacher buy-in for effective math teaching practice is top of mind. And plans only go so far. You can make, you know, detailed plans and carefully designed goals with clear objectives and key results that are measurable. But that can feel like it all falls flat if we can't engage our teachers in the work. Working with teachers who do not want to change their teaching practices is one of the most frustrating and challenging parts of our job. How do I help teachers engage in effective teaching practices when they keep pushing us away? If you can't reach the tipping point in mass adoption of effective mathematics teaching strategies, then it's likely we won't see student improvement in mathematics. We have a free training an accompanying workbook for leaders of mathematics like you. The Make Math Moments team, myself, John, and Kyle, walk you through our four-stage process we use with district partners to create clear, measurable, sustainable PD action plans, but more specifically on how to also get teacher buy-in so that it drives student engagement. So step one, register for this free training, get your planning workbook, and then watch the training. Schedule some time on your calendar so you can watch it and go through the workbook. After completing that workbook, you're going to have a clear, measurable vision, action plan for mathematics to get more teacher buy-in, but also be able to hit your goals for the 2024-2025 school year. So head on over to makemathmoments.com/4 stages to start this free training.